Welcome to Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today is March the 11th, 2009. I'm here with Josh Lambert, the author of a new book called American Jewish Fiction, published by the Jewish Publication Society in Philadelphia. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, thanks.
We are in New York City recording at the Center for Jewish History on 16th Street in New York. I think it's an appropriate place, despite the presence of Bernard Madoff's name on the wall. Can you tell me a little bit, Josh, about this book and how it came about?
This book is it's a guidebook to Jewish American fiction. It's for anyone who reads or is curious to read more Jewish American fiction. And what the book is intended to do is to guide you through the sort of breadth of that tradition. So I think that, you know, anyone who hears the words American Jewish fiction probably has some author that they will relate to that, whether it's Philip Roth or Saul Bellow or Cynthia Ozick or someone like that. My book covers 125 authors and tries to give a sort of wider sense, a more historical, rich sense of all the different kinds of writers who wrote about being Jewish in America.
And who's the earliest writer that you write about in the book?
The first book that I feature is called Differences, and it's a novel by a man named Nathan Meyer, who was apparently a doctor in the Civil War, and his book came out in 1867. And it's this sort of rich, rollicking Civil War romance, a little bit sentimental by our standards, but fascinating in that it was written, you know, of the moment. It came out in 67 about the Civil War and very much about the push and pull between Jewish families in New York and in the South, their allegiances to the different to the Confederacy and to the Union, and the conflicts that arise within the Jewish community at that time.
And would you say, I looked up the book and I discovered, of course, that it's not in print, which I thought was fairly unusual. Although you can read it in Google Books online, which is maybe, you know, a reasonable way to read a book like that, but maybe not. But just curiously, or my curiosity about that was, why do you think that book has not been in print? Why would people not read it today, even though, I mean, recognizing, of course, the style of writing of the 1860s is certainly different than style of writing today. And there aren't that many 19th century writers of any ilk that are in print. It seems like, you know, odd that the first recognized Jewish American novel would be out of print.
It astounds me, honestly, and I don't know that I have a good explanation for that.
Even with a, you know, perhaps a, maybe this is, you know, we talked about this earlier, that maybe this is something that a scholar or a writer of today might want to write a gloss on or an introduction to bring it back.
Absolutely. I mean, and as I worked on my book, I had always known about that novel, about Differences, in reading histories of writing in America and Jewish writing, but I had never been able to get my hands on it myself, because there are very few library copies, and mostly it's available in microfilmed versions.
Right, which is impossible.
Which is just, I mean, I can read a book on Google Books without feeling too miserable, but reading a book on microfilm, I think, would kill me. So,
are you a historian?
I'm more a literary scholar, actually, by trade. Okay. My academic work shades over to cultural history.
You're getting your PhD now?
Yes, I'm supposed to be finishing my PhD this summer. I'm supposed to defend the dissertation on June 3rd. So we'll
hope that happens. The dissertation on? Is it related to this?
It is related. In my studies, I do work on American Jewish writing. That's a scholarly study of a topic that might be of interest to people, in the sense that it's on obscenity in American Jewish writing. I look at not just the representations of sex in American Jewish, in the works of American Jewish writers, but I also go back and look at the history of freedom of speech activism and basically the law of obscenity. And there's a fascinating group of American Jews who fought very hard for freedom of expression, and I look into the ways that freedom of expression has been meaningful to Jews and how that's played out in Jewish writing.
And part of Jewish culture and
yeah.
the sense of being an outsider, meaning perhaps that it's necessary to defend the right to be yourself.
Exactly, and the argument towards minority rights has always been a crucial part of freedom of speech activism, so that's definitely a huge part of it.
Well, and sorry, I kind of distracted you from talking about this book, and again, it's American Jewish Fiction. It's, you know, initially when you see it, it's fairly monographic looking, but I found it very rich. And what I thought was, you know, I think most people would do is dip in and sort of look at the people that they know immediately. But what I thought was really interesting was how many writers in here that I had never heard of before. And, you know, I feel like I'm a fairly well-read person, and I know American literature pretty well. I've read a lot of it. But maybe you want to talk about some of the people in here. Now, even people who I had not even recognized in my own reading were Jewish, which was really fascinating. Now, first of all, I've read Edward Dahlberg, and I think probably not very many people today have, but I have never heard of Myron Brinig. Can you talk a little bit about him, just as an example?
Sure. Brinig is another one of these cases of a writer who it's difficult to imagine that he hasn't gotten more attention lately. His first novel, which was called Singerman, let me just check, what year did that come out? In 29, I think?
29, yeah.
So that came out in 1929, and it's, if I'm remembering correctly, and I did read a lot of books for this, but that book, Singerman, is set in Montana, in a town, I think based, I'm trying to remember exactly which town it's based on, but it's this frontier sort of mining town or a cowboy town, and the novel tells the story of a Jewish immigrant from I think Romania who comes and settles in Montana and opens the general store. And each chapter, it's a little like, I think I compare it in here to Winesburg, Ohio. It's a little bit like that, in the sense that each chapter focuses on a different character, mostly
so
Singerman's sons.
Okay.
And it gives you a sense of the different directions they're headed in. So one of the sons marries a Christian Scientist, and one of the sons is a boxer, if I remember. But what's, I think, most fascinating, maybe from our perspective today, is that one of the sons is homosexual, and for the description, to have a description of a homosexual, even obliquely and euphemistically, which is what you mostly get in Brinig's work, that early in American fiction is fairly unusual and fairly striking.
So the outsider idea kind of is a thing. And of course, you know, so many of these, I read a lot of the descriptions of these novels, particularly ones that I'd never heard of. You know, clearly they're going to be immigrant experience novels. We might posit that more educated Jews who came to America are more likely to have written a kind of self-conscious novel of their time. But would you agree, or maybe you have a better idea than I do, certainly, what are the themes besides the immigrant experience? What kinds of things, like you've talked about, this idea of talking about other and minority experience or kind of unusual experience, what else?
I think the main one, and one that gets that has gotten a lot of attention and sort of anxiety around it in American Jewish culture generally, is what we can list under the heading of assimilation. And the great critic, a critic who I admire very much, Leslie Fiedler, when he was writing about American Jewish literature, one of the things that he pointed out, which I think is fascinating, is that one of the just crucial and standard themes of American Jewish culture is the story of a Jewish young man and a non-Jewish young woman, or a Jewish young woman. And what Fiedler didn't point out is that it's just as common to find stories of a Jewish young woman and a non-Jewish young man. What he pointed out, I think very intelligently, is that those stories are a way for American Jews to think about where their place is and how they fit in American culture. And it ranges from the love affair with America that you have, and that to me, I read Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint, where you have a young Jewish man lusting after non-Jewish girls, as part of this tradition of Jews truly falling in love with America, loving America so much they want to possess it, they want to be with it in every possible way.
Right.
And Roth does an amazingly, I think, hilarious job of turning that into a sexual metaphor in the most outlandish, exuberant kind of way. But I think you see that theme just running through the novels from the very beginning of the tradition to the novels published in the last few years. You have in the 1890s, you have Emma Wolfe writing, an Alsatian Jew living in San Francisco, writing about the rapport between this rich, well-off, very cultured Jewish community in San Francisco and their non-Jewish neighbors. And it runs the gamut through novels in the 80s about relationships between Jews and Asian Americans, African Americans, which speak to, on some level, the identity politics of that time and how the different communities were relating to each other. And then you have in the most recent wave of Jewish American writing, you have these young Soviet writers, and there's a novel that I don't mention in here, I believe, called Memoirs of a Muse by Lara Vapniar, a young Russian writer. And in that novel, you have the story of a young Russian Jewish immigrant having a love affair with a sort of older American Jewish man. And here clearly you have the same technique applied to the question of how do these Russian Jews fit in with the established American Jewish community. So what one thing that I think you see in the fiction is this amazing way that the push and pull of culture gets turned into the push and pull between two people, and the love affair with America, or the ways that we feel that a Jew can feel rooted in a traditional culture, gets played out in family relationships and sexual affairs.
Well, it seems like natural to assume. And of course, I look back to some of the earlier periods, but as you sort of trace this through, you can see how American Jewish fiction must change as the position of Jews in America change, as America itself changes. But it's really interesting to see kind of themes develop here, because you have Howard Fast, who was politically radical. You have Joe Sinclair, who was really identified, in my mind, I had no idea, actually, that, you know, she was Jewish because I had read her as a feminist, you know, earlier. And, you kind of see that there are the middle class Jews, there are the kind of Jews of contemporary culture, then there's the throwbacks. I mean, you have, because there is no single Jewish American fiction, the richness of this is really pretty amazing. There were even people in here who I had not heard of who were more recent, like Edward Louis Wallant. Now, I've heard of The Pawnbroker, I think, as a movie. I don't think I ever had seen or known about the book. But of the people, how did you choose? I mean, how did you get people in here?
It was certainly difficult. As a young scholar, I didn't feel like I had the authority to, by any means, craft a canon to make the decision of what should be in, what should be out. And I don't look at the book at all as the 125 books you should read and that's it, or right. Even I would never call it the 125 best books in this tradition. What I really aimed for was, as much as I could, a kind of diversity, a representation of that breadth. So with that in mind, the first thing that I did, of course, was I read every bibliography I could find of the field, and in fact, there's not really a good comprehensive bibliography for scholars, but I pieced together what I could from different periods. And then I started talking to different academic contacts that I had, and while I did go to a few people who specialize in writing about American Jewish fiction, I thought it was much more interesting to go to academics who specialize in a field that's nearby but not exactly the same thing. So at the University of Michigan, where I'm getting my PhD, we're lucky to have Alan Wald, who's a truly extraordinary scholar of communist and socialist American writers. He has the encyclopedic knowledge of literature of almost anyone I've ever met, and by talking to him, he could give me suggestions of writers who truly, in the general studies of American Jewish writing, you never hear about, but he knows about because he's requisitioned their FBI file from using the Freedom of Information Act, and he knows everything about them, and he also knows about some novels that they've written. So an example of a book that he turned me on to, which is just a wonderful book, is Vera Kaspari's Thicker Than Water. And some people have heard of Vera Kaspari for her mystery novels and, you know, and for the movies that I think were based on her work. This novel is just a terrific, rich, very 19th century in style, family epic about a group of Sephardic Jews living in Chicago and how their lives change as the decades pass on. And it's a beautifully rich, very readable epic that speaks to a part of the American Jewish experience that too often gets forgotten, because we too often think the American Jewish story is of a Russian immigrant in the 1880s who came to America and worked in a sweatshop and then moved to the suburbs in the 50s and then, you know, became a doctor in the 80s.
Right, the classic story.
But the stories we get of these Portuguese immigrants, these Portuguese Jewish immigrants who think of themselves as completely separate from even the German Jewish immigrants who came in the 1840s and 50s, they look down at the German Jewish immigrants as scum and dreck, and they live this fairly traditional, very wealthy existence in Chicago years before Jews ever arrive in New York and start filling up the Lower East Side. And so to get a sense for these kinds of stories, I think is fascinating. So I talked to a scholar of communist literature. I talked to some people who are to particularly the writer Eileen Pollack, who I also know, I've also studied with a little bit, who was able to turn me on to some great, more contemporary novels that people don't tend to think of as Jewish novels. And I think the absolute stunner in that group was Stephen Milhauser's first novel. Stephen Milhauser is an extremely well-known American writer. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, I think, that came out in the late 90s. But in the early 70s, when he published his first novel, Edwin Mulhouse, I don't think anyone has ever really read carefully the traces of Jewishness in that book. And that's it's the way that book is structured is as the biography of a great American writer who happened to die when he was about 11 years old, the author of one incredible novel. And the writer being profiled is named Edwin Mulhouse. And obviously, when you read that book, you can see a kind of paralleling of Milhauser's name and Mulhouse. And what's fascinating is that there are these little tricks of autobiography, these little autobiographical snippets in Milhauser's novel, but they get effaced by the biographer who's telling the story of Edwin Mulhouse. So you get a sense that Edwin is Jewish, but only in the briefest mentions that sort of peer through the veneer of the biographer's story of this great American writer. And so there's an incredible irony and just a really powerful resonance to this story that Milhauser very carefully told the story of a Jewish writer who gets cast as an American writer. And that's what's gone on to really happen in Milhauser's own career in a fascinating way.
Well, so I think you what you're describing for me that I liked about this book is the surprise component. For me, I was finding people in it that I hadn't realized were Jewish, and it does may or may not matter that they are Jewish, but it's just part of how we locate ourselves in the world. But it also could be finding books to read that we didn't know existed, and I think that's really a great thing, you know, for that I can recommend to readers that this book is really worthwhile looking for because it's full of surprises. And, it's a tremendous compendium. But you also, I want to make sure we talk about the fact that you have a website to continue this conversation, because I think that no book as container can really contain the full breadth of what you're trying to accomplish here. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about the website and the idea that people can communicate with you about what's in the book.
Sure, I appreciate it. You asked me before about how I made the decision. So I talked to all these people and I generated a list. And I think the master list that I had that I was working with as I worked on this book was something like 300 or 400 titles. And then I started to cross off things that were too similar to each other, and I made a conscious decision not to give writers too much attention. You know, in most most books about American Jewish fiction, you're going to hear about Philip Roth 100 times. And I love Philip Roth. I think it's wonderful to talk about him. But anyone who wants to know about Philip Roth has lots of places to turn. I think it's much more valuable to bring up a new name. But anyway, so I was working down from a list of something like 300 or 400 titles, and talking with the publishers, we decided that 125 would be a good place to stop, a good limit. But of course, there's no sense, that's such an arbitrary marker, and there's no sense that those 125 books are all that someone should read in this tradition. And also, there's no sense that someone should go and read every one of the books that I list. I would never expect that or want that, to be honest. There are books in there that I don't love, but that I think are important or worthwhile mentioning. The classic one is Leon Uris's Exodus, right, which I have struggled through. Some people love it, and you know, more power to them, and he was prolific, and that's great. But I feel like I needed to include it just because it was such an important piece of the puzzle. So I think what happens when you make any kind of list of best books, certainly the famous ones that I've seen, the first reaction that anyone has is to point out what you missed and left out. And I think that's a natural reaction, and I think that's a very sensible reaction. So it was very important to me to make a companion piece for the book that's a website, because I totally agree with you that at this point in history, books are still useful for a very many things, but for being comprehensive, exhaustive guides to anything, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, I can't imagine wanting to use an encyclopedia in paper form anymore when using an encyclopedia digitally is so much more useful. Of course, reading a 400-page novel is much more pleasant when you can put it in your pocket or take it to the beach. Right. But when you're talking about reference sources, it just doesn't seem like the printed form is ideal anymore. So what I decided is that while the book version of this project would be limited and pithy and something you could take with you, you could throw it on your bedside table or somewhere else, the website is really what I'm hoping will happen is that the website will be the place that when someone reads my book or looks at the table of contents and is outraged that I left out a writer that they love, they can come to the website, suggest that their favorite author be added to this list, and say a little bit about why they feel that person fits within this category of American Jewish fiction.
So the key point, what is the website address before we have to go?
Absolutely. The website address is www.americanjewishfiction.com, so just the title of the book. And I would absolutely welcome anyone to come there. I have about 600 titles, or a little bit more than 600 titles listed there now, and I'm working on bringing even more in, so I'll be very happy to have people get there and discuss with me their own thoughts about this tradition.
Well, thank you, Josh. This has been terrific. I really enjoyed it. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast, and once again, we just finished an interview with Josh Lambert, author of American Jewish Fiction. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks very much, David.